is a certified financial planner professional. The opinions voiced in this program segment are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult with your financial advisor or tax advisor prior to investing.
And good afternoon. This is Shelley Fishman on the Bill Buckmaster Show, sitting in for Bill as he is still on his honeymoon with his bride of 44 years they're in Hawaii and having a great time, threatening not to come home. But there's all sorts of reasons why he has to come home. For instance, the market isn't doing too badly today. And when Bill's here, the market does badly. When Tuesdays happen and the market isn't down, I get very upset. So Bill's got to come back so that Tuesdays can be the kind of rotten days in the market that we're used to. All kidding aside, however, we're hoping he has a really great, great time. Again, this is Shelley Fishman. We've got a great show for you today. We have Terry Bracey in Washington, D.C., and he's going to be with us for the first half hour or so. And then here in the studio, we have Dr. Matt Hines, who just got back from Washington, D.C., working for the president. And the Department of Health and Human Services. So we're going to be talking about all things national today and maybe some things local. The Buckmaster Live Line is available. Please don't hesitate if you have a question or comment. Call us on 790-2040. Let's start right off with Terry Bracey. Terry, are you there?
Yeah, Shelley, how are you?
I am well. Terry, first of all, how are you doing? I know you had some surgery yesterday. Tell us you're doing great.
Well, I can see out of my right eye. For the first time, I just had a little cataract surgery, nothing to it. It was, you know, it's amazing. It was easier than going to the dentist. I was shocked.
Anything's easier than going to the dentist. Yeah, I had one eye done as well, and you're right, it's a non-event.
Yeah, so my right eye went from 2,400 to 2,025 overnight.
Ah, well, congratulations.
So I'm hoping I'll putt better. That's all I can say.
Well, speaking of sports, I know you're a great sports fan. How are the Nationals doing after their really terrible start?
Yeah, that was amazing. The whole town was depressed.
It's Washington.
Yeah, everybody's been touting the Nats is a great team and a World Series team, and we went out and proceeded to lose 8 or 10 games in a row, but they've made a wonderful comeback. They've won 15 out of their last 18, and they really have it going now. A young guy named Harper, it sounds a little bit like Babe Ruth these days. He's unloading home runs every game or so. And it's a great team, and it's fun to take the grandchildren out to the park. You can actually afford to take some people to a ball game. You know, you can get the $20 seats, and it's a great experience and a great team.
And now you can see all the way to home plate.
Yeah, right. We're excited about it.
That's great. Terry, you know, there's been stories out of Washington about the budget finally being passed by both houses of Congress. And then in the very next statement is, but it doesn't matter because even though they passed the budget, it's not binding. Tell us a little bit about how this works, why it works that way, and then maybe even a little bit about, you know, is there something we can do about this?
Well, that's another question, but I can give you a little bit of a sense of what's going on. The budget process is really more advisory than anything else, but it's still very important. To understand it, you have to go back to 1974 when the Budget Control Act was passed by Congress. It was really passed in response to anger over what was known as impoundment. Congress would pass funds in the appropriations process. The President Nixon would sign the bill, and then he'd simply impound the funds and not spend them. Well, they went to court, they did everything they could, but ultimately they decided on the Hill that if the legislative branch doesn't formulate its own national budget, instead of depending upon the executive branch to do so, we'll never be in the game. And so what happened was, over a period of a year and a half, the Budget Control Act of 1974 was drawn together and passed both houses. And what it did was, importantly, it set up the Congressional Budget Office, which became a competing arm, essentially, to the President's Office of Management and Budget. So Congress created, in effect, its own economic bureaucracy in order to have the capacity to write a national budget. And believe me, you're talking, you know, you're talking trillions and trillions of dollars.
Sure, sure. Terry, just as clarification, did President Nixon have to sign that?
He did. He did. And, no, I'm trying to think whether Nixon signed it
or Ford.
Ford. Yeah. Maybe Ford signed it. I think Ford signed it in response to the Nixon years. But in any event, that's what brought it about. And then internally, in the House of Representatives and in the Senate, there was also a great deal of resentment towards the old Appropriations Committee, which was then chaired by George Mahon of Texas, who's a wonderful, regal, elderly member of the House, but he was also an absolute dictator. And what would happen was that the authorizing committees, say Mo Udall's Interior Committee or John Dingell's Commerce Committee, would pass a law authorizing spending on something, and then the Appropriations Committee would simply do what it wanted. And that's the way it worked. And so they all, the Udalls and all the other committee chairs, they got behind this budget process because they felt that it would strengthen the hand of the authorizing committees against the Appropriations Committee.
I got it.
So those were the two big developments that were behind the creation of the congressional budget process. But Shelley, as you know, and as we started out here, why do we go through this whole process? And it's basically advisory, and that's an interesting question. And of course, the answer is that reforms never happen all at once. It was a big enough step in the 1970s to go from nothing to having a congressional budget process. But you couldn't, at that point, they didn't have the power to say, okay, this budget that we enact is going to be a law. And so instead, they said, well, we can't make it a law, but we can make it a concurrent resolution, which is basically an understanding among the House and the Senate. We concur. We agree on this. So they could get that far. And I think what you're running into today, because they did not take the next step and force it to go through the process of becoming a law with a presidential signature, what you're increasingly finding is that the budget itself is becoming a political document, kind of a sales document.
Sure.
And this year, the Republican majorities have used it to sell their ideas of privatization of Medicaid and their changes in Obamacare, et cetera, things which the president will never sign, but which sort of lay out their policy objectives.
And all of those things, if they were to find their way to the president's desk, they'd find their way there through the appropriations process?
They would. They'd have to. The budget process relates to the appropriations process in this way. A budget is written early in the year, and the overall limits on the budget are theoretically set, and the budget committee reports then to the appropriations committees, and the appropriations committee then divides up among its 13 subcommittees, which go into all corners of the federal government, how much they theoretically can spend. Now, what happens is that you get into a lot of internal fights where the Appropriations Committee objects to what the Budget Committee said, so they ignore them, or they go along perhaps with some radical suggestion, say to privatize Medicaid, and they run smack into a presidential veto, which comes, as you say, on an appropriation bill.
I got it.
So, you know, what the next step in this is really fascinating, and really, I believe, will happen. The next generation of leaders will do this, and I think what they'll do is they'll finally figure out that we need one national budget instead of having these two parallel universes, with the Congressional Budget Office and the Office of Management and Budget, I think a law will eventually be passed that said the budget has to be a law. And by doing that, they will draw in the president from the beginning, and they will have to agree on a law, which is a budget, and then you will see the end of these 2,000-page continuing resolutions and so on, the foolishness that goes on at the end of Congress.
Sure, sure.
And you'll see a great deal of organization from the top down on the federal budget. So I think that's the next step, and I would certainly strongly advocate it.
But under the current system, we're likely to see the kinds of conflicts that we have gotten used to over the past several years on total spending, on whether to extend the debt limit, on also the word is escaping me, how we cut the budget by 10% a couple of years ago, sequestration. Hmm.
That's right. You're going to see, continuing efforts to kind of deal with these two parallel universes.
Sure.
And come to some conclusion, but inevitably it comes at the end of the day instead of at the beginning of the day when we should have it.
Right.
The way every other business is run, every other government's run, you got to have a budget. City of Tucson, got to have a budget.
Terry,
State of Arizona, got to have a budget.
Well,
and federal government
gets into the whole question of whether or not it has to be balanced, but let's not go there. Let me take this opportunity to take a break. And then when we come back, what I'd like to do is talk about the Pacific Free Trade Agreement. But as we take this break, first of all, I'd like to remind our listeners that our hotline, the Buckmaster Live Line, is 790-2040. And also remind our listeners that this portion of the Buckmaster Show has been brought to you and presented by Silver City and Grant County, New Mexico. And, it's just 3 hours east of Tucson. And coming up this coming weekend on Memorial Day is the 20th Silver City Blues and Bikes Festival featuring legendary blues master Taj Mahal. You know, you can get a complete listing of the many things to do and the great places to stay in New Mexico by simply visiting southwestnewmexico.org. With that said, let's take a break and we'll be right back.
Attending Pima Community College means success for you and your family at less than a quarter the cost of trade schools or four-year universities. Partnering with business leaders, Pima creates programs tailored to help you succeed in today's high-demand jobs and offers two-year associate degrees that transfer to universities nationwide. Whether your goal is a new career or transferring to a four-year college, Pima Community College can help you succeed. Call 206-4500 or visit pima.edu.
The average person in the USA today takes over 12 prescription medicines each year, and if you are over age 65, it is more than 17 medicines. CredibleMeds.org is a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping inform you and your healthcare providers. Over 30,000 people die each year from reactions to their medicines. Don't be one of those numbers. Be informed and stay safe. Visit CredibleMeds.org today and take control of your healthcare by taking your medicines safely.
Another business trip? Why don't you just drive instead of fly?
Well, nobody brings me snacks or drinks in my car. Very seldom do I get to watch a first-run movie or take a nap while driving.
No, seriously. It must be much cheaper to drive.
Not really. I checked out TIA's cost comparison calculator. Flying from Tucson isn't just convenient. It can actually save money.
Flying from Tucson International Airport is convenient and cost-effective. Check out our cost comparison calculator at flytucson.com or text the word COMPARE to 51313. Fly Tucson. It's the way to go.
The Regional Transportation Authority is delivering its promises, completing 149 out of 200 intersection improvements, 48 of 80 pedestrian safety crossings, 108 of 200 bus pullouts, and 226 miles of 500 promised bike lanes. Since the 2006 voter approval of the RTA plan, some 650 projects are completed. Better roads, better transit, better choices, a better future. Learn more at rtamobility.com.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
Vero Mori is Tucson's only certified authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, panini, and salad is homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. And now at Vero Amore's lovely new location within the remodeled Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, Vero Amore is proud to announce an expanded menu and bar offerings with 16 microbrews on tap and 14 keg wines, along with two separate cooler rooms to keep the beverages at just the right temperature. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino, and on Dove Mountain Boulevard in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore on the web at veroamore.com.
We're back live. This is Shelley Fishman sitting in for Bill Buckmaster. And Bill and his bride are in Hawaii one more week, I believe. And we'll be back next week. And I'm here in the studio with Dr. Matt Hines. And on the phone, we have Terry Bracey, our guy in Washington, D.C. Terry, you still there, of course?
I am. Glad to have Matt there, too.
Yeah. Terry, tell us a little bit about the controversy over the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement. And you know, what's going on there? Is it likely to pass? Is the president going to get what he wants?
Well, Shelley, first, let's explain a little bit about what it is. The countries involved in TPP make up 40% of the world's economic production. And the agreement itself would affect just dozens of industries and everyday products and services, from clothing to medicine to food to cars to books to the internet and to banking. And the problem is that in a region of the world which has enjoyed a growth in middle class of 2 billion people over the last two decades, America's share of market has declined by 43%. So we have a real interest in, Shelley?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. We have a real interest in this. And the countries involved, just to run through them quickly, are Australia, Brunei, Chile, Peru, Singapore, Canada, Japan, Malaysia, Mexico, New Zealand, and Vietnam. Half of them we have a trade surplus with, but the larger part, the bigger countries, we're suffering pretty badly. So that's the interest and the national interest we have. And there are really two problems here. The first is procedural in terms of getting it approved. And that is that you can never move anything through the Congress, which is so big and involves so many details, if any member of Congress can amend any part of the of the agreement. So what has been given to presidents in the past, George Bush, Bill Clinton, is have been granted a process which allows them to vote it all at once, up or down. It's called fast-track authority. And there's been the first line of attack by labor, by some of the medical community, et cetera, has been to try to withdraw that ability of the president to deal in that way. I think, however, we now have the fast track out of the Senate committee and maybe on its way to passage. It's going to be a tough fight. So that's number one. There's a procedural issue that has to get through the Congress, which really sets up a vote on the substance of the agreement itself. So it's a two-part problem that the president has to deal with. It's a tough one, but there's you know, there's a lot to be said for this agreement.
Yeah. You know, Terry, the president has said that if we don't participate kind of make the rules or help make the rules, that China will. Is that a valid argument? And maybe you could, you know, peel back that onion a little bit for us.
Well, I don't really know. I mean, you're sort of getting above my pay grade here. But I will say this, that I've served in government at various levels. And one thing I've come to understand is that the U.S. extends its influence throughout the world, not merely with our military, not merely with our guns, but with the U.S. dollar. That's really where our influence weighs in. And I think in this case, China is simply dominating. I mean, we have a huge trade deficit with China, which is likely only to grow if we cannot get these tariffs and these other countries down. Now, the reason we have trade imbalances with so many of these countries in the Pacific are that they have various kinds of protections for their own industries, which you know, make it very difficult for our markets, for our products to penetrate their markets, whether it's rice or it's computers or whatever it is. There's a lot of protection that goes on. And the object of this is to break down that protection, open those markets, and to make us a real competitor with the Chinese in that region. So it's really not just to, you know, it's not just an economic matter. It's the whole idea of making America relevant in the Pacific, which is where the future is.
Mm-hmm. We have on the Buckmaster Hotline, we've got Matthew. Matthew, you have a question about the Trans-Pacific deal that's coming up?
Yeah. Hey, well, my thing is that the you have a two positions. The Republicans are don't want to participate because this is a President Obama's legacy, and there's a serious Republican group that is also anti-trade, a Tea Party right, as well as the Democratic left, which is very suspicious of because of NAFTA. I've never seen a situation worse for a president to get fast-track authority. And while economically, I'm normally in favor of a free trade agreement. I think the president is working from two weak hands. He's working from a weak hand domestically. He's also working from a very weak hand internationally. And I just don't know that this trade deal is going to be something that's going to go forward. And I do agree. I think, but if it did go forward, Terry, what benefits to Arizona, short-term, long-term?
Great question. Bye. Thanks, Matt.
Well, Arizona has a big trade economy, our farm products, et cetera. And I think number one would be the jobs that come from trade. Really, the whole NAFTA experience was so mixed and hurt so many people. At the same time, it helped a tremendous number of people in industries. So, you know, I'm not a trade expert, Matthew, but I do think that what Arizona's interest is what America's interest is, which is to propel our influence into the Pacific, which are the biggest markets for the future and for the next generations. We can't live in the past. We have to continually move forward. And there are going to be a lot of objections, and maybe this president won't be able to get this thing through, but if President Obama doesn't, I think the next president will, whether it be a Republican or a Democrat, going to happen.
Terry, that's good input. Dr. Hines has a question, actually.
Yeah, Terry. Hey, it's Matt Hines. I'm curious. There's a lot of this is kind of shrouded in a lot of secrecy. Is this normal that we can't really see a lot of the specifics of these types of agreements as they're being crafted and discussed? Is this normal for these types of trade agreements, or is this something unusual that we're seeing?
Well, I've a lot of free speech advocates have really criticized this whole process, but I take it that a lot of the a lot of the negotiations going on have to do with copyright protections and all kinds of very, very high-value products and technologies. And, you know, Matt, human nature around those technologies, there's been so much theft in the world. And, you know, we just had six Chinese nationals arrested today for basically stealing U.S., trade secrets. I think it increasingly and unfortunately in this world where everything is public, people tend to get more and more and more closed about what they're doing. I think it's just a natural thing. But I understand and I hear the argument. I'm a free speech person myself, but I also think that we have to do something in the Pacific other than sail our Navy around and get in a situation where we might only be viewed as a military power.
These are, of course, existing trading relationships that we have, but they are unstructured in that they're one-offs, so that every product we trade, every relationship is negotiated separately, whereas this would lump things together in a way that theoretically would create a more open relationship with these countries. There will, of course, be winners and losers, and you know any such agreement would include some winners and losers. And I think, you know, when you take a look at the trade unions and some other groups, they are fearful that what will happen is that that jobs will be continue to be exported, and that the quid pro quos are not adequate to overcome that. There's also, you know, issues of human rights. But, of course, we'll have to see what comes out since none of us has read that bill.
And, you know, it's important that organized labor stand up for its people and make its positions known. Very important that that be done. Also realize, though, that they're under the trade laws, there is a program for job losses that essentially is an unemployment insurance program for those who have lost their jobs as a result of a trade act like this. So there is some cushion in the system, but it's a tough world out there.
Yeah, Terry, before I let you go, is just one more question. Is there a time limit here? Is there something that is going to force a decision in the near future so that the president can continue?
I think there is. I didn't really look at that. The time limit is that you're running into a presidential election.
Well, there's that.
And you better get it done before then. Mm-hmm. I think it's being given a very high priority by the leadership, actually, of both parties. And we'll just have to see where it goes.
Terry, thank you for your time. I hope your recovery from yesterday's cataract surgery continues on course. Have a great Memorial Day weekend, and we'll talk to you very soon.
Thanks. I'm going to play a golf tournament.
There you go. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with Dr. Hines.
The Southern Arizona News Examiner, reporting the stories missed by the mainstream media. Our sources bring you regional, national, and international news from a different perspective. Opinion from Emil Franzi, Phil Richardson, and other top national columnists. Plus, Eric Peters with auto reviews, Bob Garver on movies, Rebecca Guthrie on books, a section on Western heritage, and sports coverage, too. It's a cross-section of information found nowhere else. SOAZNewsX.com, published Mondays and Thursdays. Subscriptions are free at SOAZNewsX.com.
Ready to do some antiquing? If you love a special one-of-a-kind object like I do, I strongly suggest Adobe House Antiques, specializing in early 20th century European and American art, and they have the best selection in town of antique light fixtures. Adobe House Antiques in the Jostler Design Building at 2700 North Campbell, 325-9439, and on the web at adobehouseantiques.com.
Another business trip? Why don't you just drive instead of fly?
Well, nobody brings me snacks or drinks in my car. Very seldom do I get to watch a first-run movie or take a nap while driving.
No, seriously. It must be much cheaper to drive.
Not really. I checked out TIA's cost comparison calculator. Flying from Tucson isn't just convenient. It can actually save money.
Flying from Tucson International Airport is convenient and cost-effective. Check out our cost comparison calculator at flytucson.com or text the word COMPARE to 51313. Fly Tucson. It's the way to go.
Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary works to end the senseless abuse of horses and burros so these noble creatures can live free of pain and suffering. Its ranch in Amado is home to dozens of rescued equines who receive special care as they await new, loving homes. Won't you help? Visit equinevoices.org. Equine Voices, a voice for all equines who cannot speak for themselves.
As a small business owner, I know the importance of a certified public accountant you can trust. That's why I recommend my CPA, Michael C. Flowers of Flowers, Rieger & Associates, proud sponsors of the Buckmaster Show, located at 2919 East Broadway and on the web at flowersrieger.com, or follow the live link on buckmastershow.com.
Are you a landlord by choice or by force? Experiencing a job transfer and don't know what to do with your current house? Want to move but can't sell your current house? Hello, my name is Ken Adams, co-owner of Rincon Ventures Property Management. Rincon Ventures has a fully automated accounting process, electronic payments, and 24-hour access to your accounts. With some of the lowest rates in Tucson, Rincon Ventures has grown rapidly in this down economy. Let us show you why. Give us a call at 881-2258 right now and experience the difference. Rincon Ventures, where service is a fact, not another empty promise. 881-2258.
This is Bill Buckmaster. The Buckmaster Show features Arizona newsmakers and more than two dozen Buckmaster Show contributors. Everything from foreign affairs to the arts is on the table and open for discussion and your calls from one end of Southern Arizona to the other. The Buckmaster Show, weekdays noon to 1 on AM 1030 KVOI, The Voice.
And we're back live. This is Shelley Fishman sitting in for Bill Buckmaster, gone for one more week in Hawaii. But we have good weather here, too, so no complaints here. Next two segments of the show, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Matt Hines. Dr. Hines is familiar to most people here in Southern Arizona, not only as one of our representatives. He represented District 29 for two terms, but he was honored to have been appointed by the president and to be the director of provider outreach in the Department of Health and Human Services, where he served in Washington for almost 2 years. Nice segue from you know, Terry Bracey being in Washington, and now Matt, can I call you Matt?
Of course.
Okay, is Matt coming back here? Though Matt does tell me that even though he was appointed and working in D.C., he'd you know, stay in his job as a doctor and come back on weekends. So tell us a little bit about Washington, what you did, what the job was about, why it was fun to do, and now you're back here full time.
Sure. Well, thanks again for having me, Shelley. And, you know, working in D.C. is it was very eye-opening. I got to learn a lot about federal agencies, how they work, how they don't work sometimes. But the White House asked me to come and basically work with other physicians and nurses, pharmacists, hospitals across the country, and to just really help them understand sort of the details of the Affordable Care Act and help to implement the law. And I stayed for two whole implementation cycles. And, you know, unfortunately, things are looking pretty good compared to the very first, compared to where we were 2 years ago with some of those website glitches. I mean, we're now at a point where we have 25, 26 million people who are directly benefiting from that law. But a lot of my work was in D.C., with the Secretary of Health and Human Services, but also traveling around on her behalf to states, especially where physician groups and nurses and hospitals were struggling to implement the law or just trying to figure out how the law works and how it was going to work best for their patient. So my role was really to be a liaison to the medical community, to other health professionals, to help them figure things out and to sort of do a lot of myth busting. It was a very politically difficult time because of all the lies, frankly, and all sorts of inaccuracies about the law. And so my job was to go around and sit down with other medical professionals and say, look, this is what you can do, this is how you can do it, and this is how your patients benefit, this is how your hospitals benefit from this.
What, on the part of the medical community now, not the political community,
sure.
What were the fears that were kind of articulated to you by people in the medical community, and you know frankly, were those fears valid? Were they myths? Were they things that were perhaps matters of extreme? Talk a little bit about how that dialogue went.
Sure, and I think it surprises people. I mean, physicians, nurses, pharmacists, they're great at what they've trained to do, which is to take care of people, to take care of their patients, to fix the heart attack or to fix the stroke or to do what it is that they're trained to do. And what we aren't is insurance salespeople, right? So we don't. That's like those details are really kind of not something that we go through in medical school or nursing school. And so I think a lot of the practitioners that I interacted with were sort of at a loss, like what. We don't do this. We're not used to having to advise our patients about, you know, provider networks and plan selection and all this stuff. It's usually other people that do that. And so, but it really became kind of a part of the practice of medicine or nursing. And that's something that I figured out very early in my work for the White House and for the Secretary that providers are really smart, but sometimes ignorant of all of these details, just like a lot of people are.
Right. And it either happened simultaneously as a coincidence or as part of the Affordable Care Act that physicians' practices were becoming automated, and that was now becoming a requirement there. So there was some of that kind of built in, wasn't there?
Well, I think you're talking about electronic medical records.
Yeah.
That is something that was part of one of the was in the Recovery Act. There's some incentives for and requirements for individual practitioners, hospitals, by a certain time. It was once 2015. Now that's been pushed back a little bit to bring in electronic medical records. And that's there's a lot of safety reasons there.
Sure.
Because I mean you've seen some. Sometimes our handwriting is not the best, to say the least. And, you know, it is also not a laughing matter in the sense that sometimes pharmacists can't figure out what some of us have written, and there can be mistakes made. And medication errors alone can account for thousands and thousands of adverse events and sometimes even deaths. So one of the things that we wanted to do, this is not the ACA again, but the reason for these medical records is physician order entry and electronic prescribing and those kinds of things, and also electronic charting, really make it much easier for a system to check and make sure you're not triple dosing the anticoagulant or whatever, that you're not getting drugs that are interacting adversely or could potentially cause some other effects, or that someone reported an allergy to one provider but not to another, and the computers talk to each other and they know it. And so just really preventing medical errors and mistakes that could harm patients is one of the main reasons they did that.
So those rules were being implemented at the same time the ACA was being implemented.
Even before.
And even before.
Before.
And so there was probably some confusion there about who was responsible.
And I saw that all the time. When I would speak to, I remember a particular meeting where, and again, you know, physicians are very smart and they have their opinions and lots of different ones, and many were not fans of the Affordable Care Act. So I would, you know, I never got anything thrown at me, but sometimes I would have a not very, I guess, supportive audience. But the questions were still good, and it helped me to figure out what I can do to help them. What knowledge do they lack about the law? And they would ask questions about the SGR, which is now no longer an issue anymore. The sustainable growth rate, that ridiculous formula that kept threatening to cut Medicare reimbursements that people have probably heard about, that's now gone. But they were conflating ACA and the electronic health medical records and SGR and basically every possible concern they would have with CMS or with HHS or the feds, all of that would fly forth.
Yeah. So at a time when the political rhetoric over this particular new piece of legislation and implementation was at its peak, The president called you and said, Matt, come down here. I want to throw you in the middle of that and, you know, put you on the front line.
Right. Well, I have to say it was a pleasant surprise and a little jarring to get a call from the White House.
I bet.
Hey. Like, oh, hello?
Yeah. It's really the White House, sure. And who is this really?
Right. And what I want to be clear, it was not President Obama himself, but okay. it was high-level staff.
But you did get a letter from the president.
Yeah, I did. He sent a letter just thanking me for my almost 2 years there in service. So it was very nice.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about winners and losers, talk about a little bit more about the Affordable Care Act. I'm going to remind the audience that the call-in line for the Buckmaster Hotline is 790-2040, and also remind the audience that the Buckmaster Show is made possible in part by a generous support of Perfection Auto Works. Mike Emery and his team can take care of all your foreign and domestic automobile needs, and Mike offers a free 26-point inspection. Perfection Auto Works at 323-8650. That's 323-8650, or at perfectionautoworks.com. We'll be back with Dr. Matt Hines right after this break.
Remodeling, restoring, or building new additions to your home?
Five Star has termite and pest solutions for you. Treatments to building materials can be performed while tradesmen continue to work. Worried about treatment marks? Don't be. Our treatments will be completed before texture and paint. Five Star will provide landscaping and drainage advice to eliminate moisture and other pests and termite attractions around the home.
Five Star Termite and Pest Control, protecting homes and homeowners since 1980. 886-0045.
Five Star Pest Control. We know what bugs you.
Attending Pima Community College means success for you and your family at less than a quarter the cost of trade schools or four-year universities. Partnering with business leaders, Pima creates programs tailored to help you succeed in today's high-demand jobs and offers two-year associate degrees that transfer to universities nationwide. Whether your goal is a new career or transferring to a four-year college, Pima Community College can help you succeed. Call 206-4500 or visit pima.edu.
The Regional Transportation Authority has completed more than 650 projects to date, including pedestrian safety crossings, intersection safety improvements, and bus pullouts, plus new sidewalks and bike lanes. The Regional Transportation Authority also funds new signal technology to keep people and goods moving. We're improving safety and regional mobility for you. Better roads, better transit, better choices, a better future. Learn more at rtamobility.com.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastro pub, serving an impressive menu of craft beer and fine fare. Choose from more than 175 beers from around the world, plus wine in a full bar. Enjoy delicious soups, salads, burgers, sandwiches, hearty entrees, and more. Craft beer, fine fare, great service, and stunning views. Noble Hops, perfect for lunch, dinner, happy hour, late night, and any time in between. Open daily at La Cañada and Lambert Lane in Oro Valley.
Hi. Wouldn't you like a voice like mine talking about your business? Saying things like, thank you for calling, or press 1 for hours and directions. Well, it can. Cox Business offers Voice Manager, allowing you to get a professional voice to record your voicemail greeting. And with my voice, you'll need to warn whoever manages your lead gen data, because your customer base is about to expand. If you don't like my voice...
There's always mine.
Thank you for calling. All our customers are important to us.
How do you like that?
I think mine might be more appropriate.
You don't know that.
I can do fancy accents.
As good as this.
Make a great impression before you answer the phone. Cox Business Internet and Voice Manager is only $99 per month. Plus, get your first month free. Bundle and save today. Visit coxbusiness.com. Ends 8/30/15. Includes Cox Business Internet 10 and Voice Manager Essential. Excludes taxes and fees. Visit coxbusiness.com for details. Actual speeds vary. Other restrictions apply.
Thank you. And we're back. This is Shelley Fishman live in the studio with Dr. Matt Hines, sitting in for Bill Buckmaster. Dr. Hines was a state representative here in District 29 in Southern Arizona and former director of provider outreach working for the Department of Health and Human Services. So, Matt, let me ask you, we're talking about the Affordable Care Act, let's call it Obamacare. We know that it's a highly charged kind of political topic, but tell us about some of the results, some of the winners,
sure.
some of the losers, and what we can look forward to in over the next couple of years.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it is becoming less. When I first took this job, it was very, very contentious. But as it's being implemented, I think we're seeing kind of the Medicare or Social Security effect back in the 60s. Mm-hmm. These were very contentious laws at the time, and that over a number of years became less and less politically charged. So, but some of the, I would say some of the biggest winners are, first of all, a lot of people don't know this, but the ACA did a lot for Medicare seniors, so especially those who have prescription drug coverage on Medicare Part D, that pesky
really
donut
close
hole.
The donut hole.
Exactly.
Right,
it'll be closed by 2019, I believe, is when it's going to completely close. But that means that a lot of seniors who tend to be on fixed incomes are now going to find it easier and easier to afford their prescription drugs. That's affecting millions and millions of Americans. That's a big deal. Of course, the obvious one is now that there's 26 or more million folks on either Medicaid, expanded Medicaid in their state, or on the private option, the options of the insurance exchanges, the majority of those folks were previously uninsured or not adequately insured. So that's, of course, the winners. Those are the target of the whole law in the first place. And then I would say, because of what would happen previously when you have insurance companies restricting people from getting coverage because they have back problems or their kid has asthma or whatnot, you ended up with a lot of people who are not covered, and they would go to the hospital when things got really bad and really expensive.
They'd wait until they
would
really
wait
bad.
Until they like, okay, well, grandma's pretty blue now. I guess it doesn't make sense. It depends if grandma's 50, 63. We really need to take her in, or the chest pain really won't go away. Yeah, your heart's exploding. Come to us, all right? But couldn't go to primary care. Didn't have that kind of access to health care. Now, instead of having those hospitals and, frankly, all the other folks with some kind of insurance foot the bill for those expensive costs, that uncompensated care, you have so many more people with some kind of coverage that that is, and the coverage now is better. So hospitalization and prescription drugs and outpatient care and primary care, all those things are covered. So our health centers, and especially some of our smaller hospitals, the rural hospitals who are in really tight margins, they are doing better because the uncompensated care cost that has been just really, really making them struggle has gone down so much as a result of the ACA.
Now, hospitals tried to pass the costs of those uninsured patients
onto everyone else, right.
Through their insurance rates.
Exactly. So, like a CB, a complete blood count, a very basic lab test, isn't $275. But that's maybe what you or your insurance will get billed, because if they just bill you the $25 or $30 or whatever it actually costs, that doesn't help them recover any of those uncompensated expenses. But there's so much less that now.
So, in theory, our health insurance costs should either go down or rise less rapidly because
right.
of this kind of flow-through effect not happening.
That is exactly right. And I think that it's very early to start putting, but there are studies that are being done. The Kaiser Family Foundation does a great job. You can check it out at their website in terms of looking at the medical inflation rate. And that continues to be almost flat, compared to it was in the 5 and 6% range several years ago. It's nothing like that anymore. Part of that, you could say, is the overall economy in the past several years. But even as the economy is continuing to recover, we're not seeing that spike. In fact, the Medicare premiums that our seniors on Medicare are charged for their portion of paying into Medicare, those haven't gone up now since 2012.
Right.
And that's pretty impressive. The rate that people are being charged for Medicare hasn't changed in 3.5 years.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that you and I talked about back probably 2 or 3 years ago, mm-hmm. right here in this studio, was the fact that if this country as a society is spending 19% of GDP on, and now I'm getting into the stuff that I normally do.
Sure.
19% of GDP on medical care, whereas the people we trade with and compete with are only spending 11 or 12%.
Or less, yeah.
Or less. Not to mention the fact that we're also spending more on military and some other things.
Right.
Then how can our society hope to compete if we don't cut those costs? And I know there were some things in the Affordable Care Act that were intended to work to drive some of those costs down. So is that stuff working? Do we have any data at all? What are some of the kinds of things we're doing?
Sure. And I think that, we already talked a little bit about this, but just getting a lot of these people covered in some way, in some real way, to have health care so they can see their primary care doctor for that pesky, persisting reflux acid type stuff, which turns out to be, a warning sign for a heart attack, instead of having your heart explode and having to be, potentially drop dead and go into the ER in an ambulance. Just that alone, getting people into what's called a medical home situation, where you have a primary care or family doctor, you can go see that person or one of their staff to get these checkups, to get an EKG, to check your cholesterol, make sure you're not diabetic, talk about nutrition, weight loss, whatever you need. Getting access to that before bad, catastrophic things can happen, that's a huge driver of increasing medical costs. So just getting these 26 million people into some sort of medical home like this is a big, big deal. But the ACA did some really, I think, innovative stuff in terms of pushing forward with having health systems voluntarily participate in what's called accountable care organizations, or ACOs, not to be confused with ACA. This is, they really do love their acronyms in DC. But this is something that allows for basically innovation. Like, what works well? How can we improve outcomes, reduce the amount of certain types of infections, hospital-acquired infections, or other conditions? And what can we put into place to do that, to make patients have better outcomes and expend fewer resources while doing it? Overall, and so, yeah, just like encouraging this experimentation in a safe way for in our hospitals, in our health centers, and even in primary care offices or groups of doctors, and then kind of see what works. And there's been some results coming back showing that Medicare savings has been pretty impressive with some of these ACOs, and then we can take those examples and expand them.
Right. We have a caller to the Buckmaster live line. Josh has a question talking about what the Supreme Court is looking at right now and what the possible effects there could be. We're toward it kind of at the end of the show, so Josh, thanks for the call. Ask your question if you will.
Well, you just asked, an answer would be good now.
Okay. Hey, Josh, thanks for the question. That's an excellent question that even before I was left, we talked about quite a bit internally. I just recently visited there to check in with some folks. And the position of HHS, and nobody really believes that in the King v. Burwell case that the justices are going, it's hard to predict, but are going to throw out the subsidy. I mean, we're talking about one particular subsection of 900 and some pages. Everywhere throughout this law, it was pretty darn clear that that these state insurance exchanges would have people that would be allowed to bring that tax credit, which is a tax credit they're owed, basically, back to help pay for their health care. That's what we're talking about. And, I don't for one believe that's going to happen at all. It doesn't make sense. So Chief Justice Roberts he went out on the limb and wrote the 5-4 opinion defending the individual mandate back in 2012. I don't think we're going to see him flip on that. Frankly, listening to the oral arguments, it didn't sound like Alito was particularly swayed by the plaintiffs either. So what would happen? I don't think it's going to, so I don't know if it's helpful to speculate, but it comes down to this. Every state has its own individual marketplace or exchange. That's what the law is requiring. That's what's there. Now, what entity operates it, whether it's the state of Arizona or, in the case of Illinois in combination with the feds, or the feds at HHS themselves, that doesn't matter. There's an individual state marketplace for every state.
So I think you're saying that nobody locked you in a room in Washington and said, we need a plan B just in case.
No, it was not discussed, because that's not going to happen.
Okay. Well, this has been really interesting. I would like to thank you for coming by. We could spend an hour talking about all of the other things we haven't even touched on.
Sure.
And the stuff you were doing. That's just so exciting to have had that experience. But you're back here now, full-time.
Anytime you want.
How do you enjoy being a full-time doctor?
Oh, it's great. I mean, the working for the federal government is great, but sometimes you don't just always understand why things happen the way they happen. So, people come into the ER, they've broken something, we fix it,
Okay. Well, I would like to thank our engineer and producer, Ed Alexander, and for doing this, and thank Bill for letting me have this opportunity. So, for the Buckmaster Show, everybody have a great and safe Memorial Day weekend.
The opinions voiced in this program segment are for general information only and are not necessarily those of LPL Financial or this station. Shelly Fishman, CFP, is an LPL Financial Planner. Shelly can be reached at 520-940-0884 or at his website, shellyfishman.com. Securities offered through LPL Financial. Member FINRA, SIPC.
Intelligent Talk 24/7, AM 1030, KVOI, Cortero, Tucson. On the web at KVOI.com.